You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Valerie Martin, the author most recently of The Great Divorce, the author as well of Mary Riley, Going Backwards, A Recent Martyr, a book of short stories, The Consolation of Nature, and two earlier novels, Alexandra and Set in Motion. And I've got them all in front of me because I've been reading Valerie Martin since her first book came out, and I was in college. Now, I thought I'd begin by asking, in Mary Riley, in which a serving girl is telling about the goings-on in the house laboratory of Dr. Jekyll, also mm-hmm. known as Mr. Hyde, and in The Great Divorce, in which there's a sort of lycanthropic set of transformations, mm-hmm. that the neurosis had a known literary objective correlative. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, in mm-hmm. the case of Mary Riley, mm-hmm. Voodoo, lycanthropy, metamorphosis, mm-hmm. in the case of The Great Divorce, whereas the earlier books seem to be without a literary subtext. Mm-hmm. They seem much more hauntingly inaccessible in terms of finding the place they come from.
I think that's probably true. In a way, they do come more from a kind of personal mythology that that is probably entirely peculiar to me, and it's unrelated to anything literary. And I guess Mary Riley was the first novel I wrote in which I was openly and seriously addressing the sort of tradition of the novel. Although the stories in Consolation of the Nature are almost all studies of other stories. The story called The Frieze is modeled after James Joyce's The Dead. A woman goes to a party and has an encounter with death. There's one, in fact, that it's a direct quote from Hawthorne's Young Goodman Brown, the story of the woman who meets a wolf man at a party. Well, there's a wolf man. There's one.
Is Sea Lovers a...
That's sort of a comment on the movie Splash.
Oh.
strictly pop culture.
I guess, yeah. You know, that story for me in Consolation of Nature, called Sea Lovers, defines something very interesting. If you don't mind if I describe mm-hmm. it. Lovers are walking at night on the beach. They wander too deep into the ocean at night. They start to drown. A mermaid, seeing them, thinks of other dead creatures she's encountered. Bodies and blood wash in and out, and the story, for all of its fantastic elements, ends up sounding sort of imperturbable, like a story of mm-hmm. the tides, simply. Mm-hmm. And as a result, the story ends up seeming like a description of the imagination.
Mm. Gee, that's a nice description of it. Yeah, that was a story that I started to amuse myself to write a scary story. But I did want it to have that quality of the tide, and in fact, that's how it opens. It's a description of what the sea is like and how dark on dark things are. And it certainly is a story about the imagination, about the whole notion. In fact, what started it was my being offended by the absence of imagination in people who want to tell stories. My daughter went to see the movie Splash and told me about it, and told me it was about a mermaid who was in love with a man, and I just thought that was obscene. I had read some stories about mermaids as a child. I always loved them. And also about silkies.
Oh.
I used to love that song, The Silky. And one of the things about them I always understood was that they didn't like people at all and didn't want to have anything to do with them. So I felt this was quite an outrage to make a film in which a mermaid, of course, falls in love with a nice young man.
Well,
that's too unimaginative.
This is going to betray neurasthenia of the worst sort. But when I saw it, I started to cry, because here is a subject capable of generating great strangeness, terror, mm-hmm. loveliness, and to have left it bereft of everything but fish out of water comedy.
Right, lying on the tiles in the bathroom.
Seems so, so sad to me, as if, you know, not only was the imagination left out, but that it was being actively betrayed.
Yeah, I think, that's exactly how I felt, really. In fact, I was not able to watch the film because I've seen pieces of it, but it did seem like such an outrageous destruction of something that is mysterious, magical, and ancient and important in our imagination. So that's what drove me to try to find some way to counteract that with a story that concentrated on the darker potential of that sort of mythology of the half animal, half human, and its relationship to the imagination. I think it's true. It definitely is a story about the imagination. At the end of it, the woman looks out and sees what could be a mermaid, or she can't see what it is, and it reassures her to know it's there.
The stories, and in certain ways the novels, seem to take on the possibility of identification as a subject. Someone will see something, imagine the story as being her own, and simultaneously move toward it and move away from it. And the more dangerous the figure is, so for instance, in A Recent Martyr, the heroine is drawn to a man because of his nearly repellent and dangerous qualities, but in The Consolation of Nature and The Way of the World, a girl on a train becomes fascinated with a woman asleep next to her. It seems as if she doesn't have to do anything but grow up, the girl on the train, because the woman is asleep, and all she needs to do is feed her a sandwich. But any more consciousness in the other, any volition, is going to lead these somewhat passive imaginers into the depths. Does this ring any bell or make any kind of sense to you?
It does, in a way. I think it's fairly natural for somebody who wants to write fiction to try to imagine themselves into the heads of other people, and I certainly wanted to do nothing else but that since I was a child. But other people are so mysterious, and it's so often disappointing, or else sometimes frightening. And sometimes what's most frightening is how closely the person resembles the darkest things you can imagine about them. Now, I'm not suggesting that I've been hanging around with criminals, but that I think that a pretty serious neurosis is the common condition of most people. I used to think that everybody thought pretty much as I do, but they just didn't want to admit it. And so I would write as honestly as I could about how, and this might be the difference in the books you see, because there really was a change in my consciousness. I used to write about, as honestly as I could, about how I could see things, how the world looked to me, and it looks to me like a fairly dangerous place. But as the books came out and I got reviews, I was always treated very respectfully, and I liked the reviews. But what I could see was that people were responding to the book because they found the states of mind so alien. And for a while, I continued with my assumption that that's because they don't want to admit it. But recently, I've begun to think that maybe they do really see the world differently, and that I do have an odd way of seeing things. This was a real crisis to me as a writer. Maybe that's what drove me into Robert Louis Stevenson, where I felt, I'll go inside somebody else's book, and there I'll be safe from these accusations of strangeness, since his story is of a mind divided.
I'm talking to Valerie Martin, the author most recently of The Great Divorce. In the newest novel, the division is not, well, there are divisions within characters, two of the three and possibly four concurrent tracks in the novel belong to women now and back then who are experiencing a quasi-metamorphosis. Camille, who works in a zoo and who perhaps imagines herself to be turning into a leopard?
Yeah.
And Elizabeth, who under the surveillance and imprisonment of a cruel husband, has visited the voodoo woman in a kind of cat people scene, mm-hmm. And now is perhaps turning into a Black Panther, although there is one on the premises, escape from the zoo.
Right.
At the same time, the great divorce, at least in the book, the literal divorce, is between Ellen and Paul, whose marriage is splitting apart. But I found that the division in this book seemed to be between the various narratives, mm-hmm. at least the interesting suture points, more than the more or less simple schizophrenic division mm-hmm. of woman and animal. And I wondered what it was like to be writing three stories at once where the point is the interpenetrations.
Yeah, I like that you use the word suture, because the book originated in some ways with an image of a woman sewing up a leopard that I had in my imagination one day. And the whole idea of this suturing of the wild, trying to sew it back together again. In a way that the stories in this book are, the different stories are more about the process of writing a novel than anything I've done before. And to me, there's a big division in the book. It's a book about the dangers of romanticism, I suppose. I'm thinking of Madame Bovary, which was the big formative book in my life, in which you see that a romantic education can lead to, what it can lead to. In a way, that is the subject matter of this book to me. And the characters parallel one another. Elizabeth is a spoiled and indulgent woman who lives in a time when, she lives in a period that is a romantic period. So there's no faking it. Her education does equip her for the world that she lives in, because it's a world in which people believe anything is possible. And in fact, you can be hung for saying you turned into a leopard because you went to a voodoo ceremony. A very different place from where we live now. So the parallel to her is Camille, who also goes to a voodoo doctor. She goes to a psychiatrist, but she has the same education, the same sort of unreal expectations of life, and winds up sort of in the same predicament. And then there's finally Ellen, who doesn't really seem to have a romantic bone in her body, and takes a fairly straight look at what she sees and tries to do what she can about it. Clearly the heroine of the piece. Having the three stories going at once seemed, as I worked on it, to be natural and pleasant. They had occurred pretty much simultaneously in my imagination, linked together by that leopard. And I wrote the book I didn't write one story and then write another story. I wrote it exactly as it appears, really. I never moved a chapter. One story seeming to, in my mind, to reflect off the other, and constantly switching back between a kind of inflated, lyrical, romantic, maybe even a little bit corny fairy tale about a woman who turns into a cat because she's imprisoned by her bad German husband, to a story about women living in a very ordinary world devoid of magic, and in which not only is the image of the cat not able to save them, the actual reality of the cat is almost gone.
Well, it was interesting. As I read, something slightly comic occurred to me. I felt as if this were a cautionary tale of literature, that is to say, indulge the romantic too much, my dear character, and you will become a character in an Anne Rice novel.
Exactly. I think that's a good description of it. It's what Flaubert went on trial for, and the essential message of his book is if you read too much of this junk. I remember the long description of Emma's education, which is an entirely romantic education. She reads Lamartine and others. It'll lead you to the arsenic in the closet. And I think in some sense, yes, that is what I have in mind. I think that things haven't changed much in that way. We still are very poorly prepared to live in the world.
The first chapter of Mary Riley is probably its major shock to
yeah,
its
after that it's downhill.
readers, in which a girl is being put into a closet for punishment by her father, who then puts a rat in there with her. And I remember that not only as a primal fear in actuality, but in my imagination, I felt it as a primal fear in other literature. Mm-hmm. And then I remembered Orwell's 1984,
sure.
where the room, the mask, the rat eating the face seems to be at the center.
Yeah. Primal is the right word for that fear.
As we fold our arms
yeah.
tighter.
Just thinking about it.
Since what seems from the consolation of nature up through the Great Divorce that there's a severance between man and nature or man and the wild, is there a point where loving the rat is the desired marriage, the desired healing of that breakage?
Loving the rat? Well, no, I don't think so. I don't think there's any way to love the rat, nor any particular reason why we should any more than we love any other animal. It's harder to love a rat because they're unattractive. And I met a German once who actually said he liked rats.
But he was German.
He was a German. I wrote a poem once called Mr. Rat, which is partly about the consistent image of the rat in the imagination as a horrible creature. The rat is that part of the wild that is not only dangerous, it's also unattractive. And rats are real smart, which is another very annoying thing. And they live real close to us, and they're always around. And in some ways, of course, they suggest a dark side to our own imaginations. We know they're there. I think that's why they're so frightening. I've had lots of contact with rats in my life because I grew up in New Orleans. In fact, I was there a few days ago, and walking out of a party at the end of the evening, there was a wall next to me, and walking towards me on the top of the wall, just about eye level, was a rat. And everyone started shouting, "Oh, he knows you're in town." They always come out to see you.
Do you remember?
We just waved.
Do you remember that incredible letter of Kafka's in which he set a mouse trap, a simple mouse trap, but the mouse trap can only hold one mouse? And so while that mouse is dying, he hears the scamperings of the others and knows that they can't be killed. So he buys a mouse trap that's capable of killing four or five at once, a sort of cage-like thing. And the mice don't go near it, but all night long he hears the sound of death waiting for the mice, which is worse than hearing them dying.
No, I have never read this letter, but it certainly sounds like our friend Franz. That's great. Yeah, I guess that is another thing about rats and mice, too, is that, we can kill them. They're small. It's not like having to confront a tiger where, you really don't have much of a chance unless you got a weapon. I think that separation that this book really is focused upon, but that I see now has been sort of something I've been worrying over for a long time between... I've always been bothered by the expression human nature and how we use it. When people behave badly, we say, well, that's just human nature. We rarely use it to mean they've been heroic. In fact, we think that's valiant, like a lion. So there seems to be a real confusion in everybody's, in the common parlance, about how we feel, about what's wild and what isn't. And the same thing is true about how we feel about our own interior darker sides, those parts of our consciousness that are aggressive and violent. I think that it's the same thing, the sort of mixed up feeling we have about the wild and the mixed up feeling we have about, say, criminal impulses, because we romanticize criminals constantly in the movies, in books. Novelists are often drawn to a sort of examination of the criminal in which you discover that he, after all, is just like you or me, just a little twist here, a little adjustment there. But at the same time, it's very clear, especially now, that we feel the proper place for the criminal is behind bars, where he can't get at us. And the same is true of our feelings about the wild in nature, that as much as we admire the tiger and want to preserve the tiger, they're dangerous and should be kept behind bars or under control. And that seems to me paradoxical, and it's impossible to ever come to any terms with that. And I have no idea what can be done about it, or if there is, if it would be a good thing if we did do anything about it rather than, I'd like to just recognize it. So I guess the answer to your question is no, I don't think you have to love the rat. I don't think it would do any good.
I'm talking to Valerie Martin, the author most recently of The Great Divorce, published by Doubleday. One of the things I guess I like most about these books is that there was a strain of writing, and perhaps one might talk about Kafka, where the entrance to the horrific seemed to be guarded or made permissible by the presence of a certain kind of ironic comedy.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to be your concern in your work. We were talking earlier about John Hawkes, but mm-hmm. I could probably think of any number of writers who enter into horror with a huge snigger.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered how you feel about that kind of distancing, since it does seem to be the way American writers most deal.
Yeah. I remember hearing a story about Kafka reading one of his stories to friends, and he read a few sentences and started laughing, and he couldn't stop and had to give up. He was unable to read his work because he found it so amusing. Whereas most of us read Kafka, and although there is always that, what you describe, that element of irony and humor, the horror is overpowering.
But you seem to bypass the comic tone or the antic, you know.
I think it just doesn't come naturally to me to approach what I find frightening as if it was a joke. So I guess I'm serious about it. It's true, I noticed that other writers use this, and it is to create distance and make people feel a little safer, and to make the writer feel a little safer, because if you can go in laughing, well, I guess that makes it better.
Well, I also found myself thinking about this a lot, because these narrators, I guess for lack of a better one, Hawks, take a first-person narrator and give him a huge amount of affect.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be a serial killer or a mass murderer. He'll speak in highly inflected cadences, mm-hmm. full of long vowels and a lot of murmurous effects. And your characters seem to tend toward the affectless.
Yeah, they're rather ordinary and often passive. That is an interesting distinction.
Well, it started me thinking in all sorts of directions, because the Hawks narrators are classically gluttonous and fat,
mm-hmm.
and yours again tend toward the nervous and the small.
Mm-hmm.
It made me think that there's a whole distinction between this robust gluttony for horror and a more cautious distaste for mm-hmm. it, while recognizing it must be entered.
Well, it's probably partly too the perception of the writer of the response of the world. If you choose as your narrator somebody who is not just an outsider, but a psychotic or somebody who's very unattractive and in himself frightening, as Hawks does, then in a way you're not accountable, and it's easier to accept that this is going to be an extraordinary and frightening world, the world of the outsider. I think most novels write about outsiders. My characters are outsiders too, but they're not outsiders in the sense that they have stepped outside willfully or that they have any consciousness of being outside. They're just outside. And they feel alienated and separated from most of life. Camille is a perfect example. And the narrator in Set in Motion is another. Probably has something to do with influences. When I was in college, and I read The Stranger, I thought I have finally encountered something I could call almost a goal to speak. Of course, that character is a murderer who tells his tale. But there's nothing odd about him. In fact, he's such a pleasant guy. He likes to sit in the sun.
You've just told me, so this is sort of the banality of evil rather than the extraordinariness of evil.
Well, you know, it was hard for me to see that Mirceau is evil. I don't think he is. I think he's right in the end to want everybody to laugh at him because he's come to see what hypocrites they are, trying to bring him, as he sits in the cell, trying to bring him the consolation of God when he fired the trigger on a hot day, you know, not really knowing what he was doing or why, out of nervousness, out of the kind of fear that people around here are shooting people all the time over, you know, because somebody's in my yard. We don't think of that as a criminal activity. So I guess that's it. I don't see my characters as monsters, and I think it's better to approach what's frightening in our nature as that which can be addressed without any giggling or any nervousness, but rather straight on. And I think it's hypocritical to assume that only a murderer has murderous impulses.
Thank you. I've been speaking to Valerie Martin, the author most recently of The Great Divorce, the author as well of Mary Riley, The Consolation of Nature, and three other novels. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, no in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse. Wow.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.